Okay. Okay. So.
Yeah. Everybody else gets ignored.
Welcome to whatever this panel's called. Stay small. It's about freelancing or not freelancing. And one of the things that we're going to try to figure out on the panel is this the right move for me? Some people may leave here saying, you know what? I don't care if I lose my job in this recession because I'm ready to freelance. And other people may say, I'm holding on to that job for dear life because this is not the life for me. So that's the kind of thing we're going to... It's going to be kind of a practical, not like a super creative or inspiring panel, although I am certainly inspired by the brilliant people sitting beside me. We have a freelancer, a head of a company that is a little company that was once a very big company, and a head of a small company who was once a freelancer. And I'm a head of a small company that was once... who was once a freelancer. I'm also a head of a small company. So we'll have some different perspectives. I don't really like it when the moderator gives a long spiel, so I'm not going to. I guess the first thing to do is find out a little bit, if all the panelists would just say your name and in a couple sentences what you do so everyone knows who's talking to them, and then we can get into the substance of the panel.
You going to start?
I'm Jeffrey Zeldman. I'm the founder and creative director of Happy Cog Studios, with offices in New York and Philadelphia. We run a magazine called A List Apart, a conference called An Event Apart. I have a website, wrote a couple books.
Hi, I'm Whitney Hess. I have been an independent consultant since August of 2008. I'm a user experience designer based in New York City. And prior to being independent, I was freelancing on the side of a full-time job for 3 years.
I'm Roger Black. I'm a designer. Started in magazines and newspapers, started with websites in 95. And I am at my little studio in New York. And Jeffrey and I actually cohabit that space, which is kind of fun. And the I'm also a partner in Danilo Black, which is based in Mexico, and in the Font Bureau, which is in Boston.
I'm Christina Halverson. I am the founder and president of Brain Traffic. We're a web content agency in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Great.
And there are seats up here in this row, right here. We'd like to invite you to come and take them.
Please don't stand in the back. I mean, unless you really want to, because you're just going to fall asleep. You won't be able to hear or see.
We
can't see you. And we'd like to ask who here is a full-time freelancer? Show of hands. Wow.
Wow.
Okay.
Awesome.
Who here is a full-time employee? Okay.
Half and half.
Who is an employee who also freelances? Okay. How many of you have never freelanced or been employed? Awesome. This one's for you. Okay. Let's start with a kind of obvious. I mean, we planned this panel a year ago when it seemed clear to us that work was slowing down a little bit and that things were not the same as they had been. But no one was calling it a recession, and we didn't know that we were in a recession. Every time I would say, I think we're in a recession, my business partners would say, stop saying that. We're not in a recession. But we were. And but, you know, after this panel got approved to be here, we soon all found out that we're in kind of a very serious recession. None of us knows how serious or if we can just be happy and call it a recession. You know, we can go like... It's sort of like when you go to the clinic and find out that it's only herpes, and you're like, yeah. It's like, maybe it'll only be a recession, a very steep recession with like 10% job loss. That would be awesome because it could be a lot worse. So thinking about that, well, how many people here have lost a job recently?
Don't be shy.
Yeah, there's no shame in this at all. How many have quit a job, even though it was a secure job, in the last year or two?
Oh, right.
Okay. I'd love to find out later if we can why you did that, but the first question I'm going to ask is, like, how did everyone start out working independently, and what was the economy like at the time? And I'll start. It was 1999. I was supposedly a creative director at a .com. It was a perfectly fine company, but I didn't feel in charge of the creative product. I felt like somehow what we were doing wasn't sustainable, although I didn't use that word. I don't think I had that word then. But I just felt a little bit dirty. Like the money seemed so, there seemed to be so much money that it didn't seem natural to me, because I'd once shoveled snow for $1 an hour. And it just didn't seem like you could be charging this much money and doing everything right. And I also thought, well, I wasn't getting most of that money. I thought maybe I could make a living and work for myself. So I lined up a couple freelance clients and did. And like I said, it was like the end of 1999. And basically, as I walked out the door, the dot-com, not because of me, but the dot-com crash started happening. And I started HappyCog as a one-person agency in 2000 when people were jumping out of windows, and it was not good. And it's now, you know, an agency with locations in two cities, which is kind of awesome. So it can be done. And Whitney, what about you? When did you started recently?
Yeah, I started full-time independence in August of 2008. Like I said, I've been freelancing on the side of a full-time job since August 2005. And basically, I got to a point where the gigs that I was getting for freelance work were bigger, more interesting. I had a lot more creative control, a lot more input, and just generally gave me a greater amount of fulfillment than my full-time job, which was a wonderful company that was very secure and well-paying and everything else. So people thought I was insane for just taking the leap and saying, I want to do this. But I felt like I had a secure client base. I had people that were interested in working with me. And I thought, if not now, when? So I just went for it.
Cool, Whitney. I'm gonna skip over to Christina. When did you start working for yourself? And
we'll get to you, Roger.
Yeah, and what was the economy like and all that?
So I lost my last job on September 12th, 2001, which was awesome. And I was getting married 2 months later, so I was kind of busy with that. And when I finally came up for air, there were no jobs, and I very quickly realized I was going to need to make something up for myself. So I did not start with any kind of a secure client base. I started with nothing, and I kind of sat down alone with myself in a room and thought, okay, well, I need to make money, and no one is hiring, and what are some things that I feel really, really confident about? Because I kind of knew a lot, or I knew a little bit about a lot of things. And the one thing that I always felt really good about from job to job was my writing, my copywriting skills. So this was back when you had to go to Office Max and actually purchase little business cards that you ripped apart. And I printed those out on my inkjet printer. And I started handing them out around my neighborhood, the local restaurant, wherever, just saying, I'm a copywriter. And the more often I said it, the more I actually believed it. And it was a relatively, I think, common trajectory, which is that I slowly built a client base who then slowly began to give me more work than I could handle. And it finally got to a point in autumn of 2005 where I was ready to hire someone full-time and make that commitment. So I will also mention, which I maybe should have in the introduction, that we're on a trajectory right now where this time last year I was preparing to hire my fourth employee, and now I have 14 employees. So this has been a very interesting time for us, especially in a weird economy. So,
Before we get to Roger, I want to go back to something, because I heard a lesson in what you said, which is pick something that you think you're good at and focus on that. Right?
Yeah.
You picked of all this. You had a lot of skills, kind of a generalist. Said, you know, I'm pretty good at writing. I feel pretty confident about that. I'm going to call myself a copywriter. And who here called themselves a web designer or a web developer because they, you know, they started to feel pretty confident about it, or anyway pretend that they could feel pretty confident about. I mean, I think that's pretty relatable. Right?
Yeah, and when I have people ask me about that, this is sort of the litmus test that I use, where if you had to stand up in front of a room of 20 really, really smart people and kind of hold forth on something, anything, for 10 minutes, and you weren't going to feel like you were kind of faking it or worried that they were going to call you out on anything, whatever that thing is that you could talk about for 10 minutes, that's likely something that you could make money on.
Cool. And Roger?
Well, I think this all gets back to doing what you would do anyway. If I think it's really crazy it's hard to think of this as a business because it's certainly not a lucrative business. It's very hard to make a lot of money being a designer. I think that any designer who's made money, it's because had some lucky moves along the way. But the thing is that if you were going to do this anyway, then it's really good to do it on your own because a boss is only going to get in your way in the long run. And now there's something else going on, which is there are so many good people who are designers and developers for the web that having a big factory filled with them is an insane idea. It's so much smarter to put together, like a movie, a team of people for a project, of freelancers, and they can be all over the country now, and that's what we do, and it's really great. Some of them I've known people for a long time, and they get recoalesced, and sometimes we get mad at each other and don't want to do the next one together or something like that. But for the most part, it's a regular kind of ensemble team. But everybody's on their own. Everybody has their own website. Everybody has their other clients. And it's great as somebody who I've had at the worst case at Circle.com, we had 200 designers, which is an utterly impossible management problem, and we had probably 120 developers, and graphic designers and web developers have very similar personalities in terms of. They don't want to get to work early. They don't really like a lot of rules. And so it's much better if you work with them as freelancers. I think from a point of view of getting really great work, the system that's emerged of some people working alone all the time for specific little projects and some people working as parts of teams some of the time is okay. It's certainly effective. And it's cheaper for the client in the long run.
It's interesting. You're talking about the new Hollywood model versus the old Hollywood model. The old Hollywood model.
The studio, right?
You worked for Warner Brothers, and they'd say, you're not going to write that gambling picture anymore. Now you're going to write that wrestling picture. And they just, they'd say, well, put this writer on it. And we can't get that actress? Well, because she's on this other shoot. So, and they controlled everything. And that's how, a company like Razorfish would work. And a lot of big enterprise-scale web agencies would work. And what always appealed to me.
I think it's really important.
The smaller one where you just bring people in who are good for a specific project and pay them well and treat them well and really, when I'm at the top of the pyramid on a project like that, for me the most important thing is defend their work. Pick good clients for them and defend their work so they'll want to work for me again, right? Because otherwise they won't.
And get their work to happen.
Get to work to make it happen. Otherwise, nobody wants to work for you.
Yeah.
Something that Christina said actually reminded me that when I started freelance in August of 2005, I was not just doing what I do now. So I have an education in human-computer interaction. I consider myself a user experience designer. I do a lot of information architecture, interaction design kind of work. But when I first started this freelance thing, people were just coming to me to help them build their website. And I was actually doing the whole end-to-end website development for very small businesses getting paid nothing. And because I was getting paid nothing, I didn't want to hire anyone who could do stuff that I really couldn't do, like graphic design, for instance. And so I was doing it myself. And the projects are laughably bad, and I would never even tell you what these clients were because the websites still exist and they're out there, and I did the visual design. And it took me 3 years to get to a point where I was able to just accept that what I'm really great at is user experience design, and that's what I wanted to focus on, and then seek out those clients. So I don't think I ever would have quit my job if I was forced to do all this other stuff that I know I'm really bad at. I finally just accepted this is what I am, and now I can position myself a lot better to get the work that I like.
Let's talk about two things. Finding clients and finding better clients. Okay, because first of all, when we started talking, my story was I walked out of a job, right? And I said, and I lined up some freelance clients. But how did I do that? How do people do that? Because some people may be sitting there thinking, my job's not secure right now, And I think I have the personality and certainly I have the skills to be a freelancer, but how do I get those first couple of clients? So I'd like to have everyone talk a little bit about that, like how they find, how they get clients. And then a second, more interesting phase, I think, is when you start to get better clients or get rid of your bad clients, which is a whole other thing. And it's fun. But first you need some good clients before you can get rid of your bad clients. So let's start by just those initial clients. I mean, when I walked out, I lined up $6,000 worth of work, which seemed like a fortune to me when I started. But that was like three websites, right? I mean, that's kind of crazy now. For me, like, they were people who'd either read something I'd written and they emailed me and said, you know, so one way for me that I got the word out was just by writing stuff, whether it's in a newsletter or meetup or speaking at your local AIGA or anything like that. Anything that you can do to get the word out will get you at least somebody who has some money who might need your services. How did you go about getting clients?
Well, I started out with family and friends, and that eventually grew into their family and friends. So at least it was one person removed. But then over time, because I had worked for two interactive marketing agencies ridiculously high turnover, and those people had gone to other agencies and other corporations where they, you know, needed someone like me and remembered me, I was always reaching out to people to tell them that I was available. And when I went full-time freelance in August, I sent out emails to everyone I knew on LinkedIn. I talked about it on Twitter all the time. I blogged about it. And I told people that I was available. But I had been lucky in that I had worked with a lot of people who were spread out and working in a lot of other places. And slowly but surely, they would vouch for me or they would refer me to someone else. And just coming to events like this and telling people who I am and what I do, I mean, it's about making connections. It's all networking. I've never had to respond to an ad that was posted on a job board or post my services on Craigslist or anything else. I really just worked the network as best I can, and I do it every day.
So if you're a person who goes to a party, doesn't introduce themselves to anybody, and sort of stands in the corner nursing the same drink all night, maybe freelance isn't right for you. You have to be, and there's nothing wrong with being that person. I'm secretly that person, right? But you have to be able to get past your own natural, and I think a lot of creative people are shy. A lot of people are shy. Creative people are shy. You have to kind of get past that and not be afraid that someone's going to laugh at you or tell you you're stupid and they don't want to work with you and you're ugly. Just...
Completely that person. I didn't want to talk to anyone. And then a year ago when I decided, you know what, I think I want to do this freelance thing full time, I decided I couldn't be that person anymore. And I realized that there's something that I know, something that other people don't know.
Yep.
And you can bring that up in conversation, and then you have to recognize that there's something that they know that you don't know, and you remember those people, and then you're resources for each other, and that's just how the work gets spread around.
Yeah, I want to say something else, too, which is that, you know, when I first went freelance, I was like, oh, my God, I'm going to have to go to all of these, like, lame marketing association meetings, and I'm going to have to go and do these icebreakers and be like, hi, I'm Christina Halverson. Hey, how's it going? Here's my card. And, you know, ultimately, like, if that's not your deal, right, there are other ways to connect with people and with potential clients that don't have to feel inauthentic or cheesy to you, right? Twitter is amazing for this, as I'm sure many of you know. Who here does not check their at replies every single day? Right? You? Yeah. Once in a while you do? That's good. It's good for the cleanse. Do you know what I mean? But, you know, there, I for one, typically, like, I built my business on food, literally. Like, who is going to turn down a free lunch, right? So I had no, I never advertised, I never did any kind of marketing, anything like that. I called people and offered to take them to lunch in fancy restaurants. And I would sit down with them, and most of the time for the first 45 minutes, I wouldn't even talk about copywriting. I would ask them, get them talking about their agency and what they're doing. And that was a very comfortable, authentic environment for me then to begin to introduce sort of, well, you know, this copywriting thing. So, yeah.
I think my advice on that score is start small. A lot of people, to advance their career, think that they need to work for the high-profile, famous, big company. And as a fourth-level person, I think that's completely wrong. I think that that if you start out of town, if you start with something, a small website that you can completely control, or at least get your code into or get your design into, then, and that works, then you have the beginning of a list of links that you can give people and put on your blog and say, hey, this is what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And it can be just completely tiny, even not-for-profit, something that really sings. And the word gets around. It's really interesting. It can be the most minor kind of thing, but if it's great, people see it and pass it along. And then they ask, who did that?
And yeah, if you work for, there's two kinds of like not-for-profit agencies. There's the kind that don't have money, and those are the kind that you can totally get, right, as clients. Then there's the kind that that have a lot of money or have some money, and those are the kind you can get someday. But right now, we started doing like local churches and stuff, and then at a certain point, I got Amnesty International USA, and they had like, I wouldn't call it money. They had sort of lunch money. But who cared? Because it was Amnesty. And after that, every university, I mean, because we did a halfway good job, universities and nonprofits started knocking on the door. And some of them also had no money. And so you have to scratch your head and go, how many free jobs can I do? But yeah, it's a great way in. It's a great way to visibility. Another visibility raiser. How many people here tweet or blog or write in some capacity? Okay,
great.
That's almost everybody. And really, the best thing you can do for your career, every hand should be raised. My career, to a large extent, the internet enabled me to have a career just because I wrote. I started writing on my site, and I got some readers. And then at some point, I had a magazine, got some more readers, and a newsletter. And you just keep going and going and getting more readers. And eventually, like a really big client for me was a man in Dallas who said, I finally got to the point where I'd written for Adobe, and he saw that article. He didn't see any of the other stuff, and he said, I really like what you wrote. Do you design websites? Just like that, you know? So first there's like years of writing for your local publication or your local newspaper. You know, maybe you hit up the local journalist, take them out to a... Well, if they're a journalist, you probably don't have to take them to an expensive lunch, just... Any lunch.
I want to echo what Jeffrey said because, honestly, for me, I mean, you're talking about you did a small project and then you can show that project. I truly do not believe that my portfolio has ever gotten me a gig. I've got some cool stuff in there and I'm proud of it, but I think what gets me the client is the process that I have. I mean, I'm very specialized, and so I can go into a prospective client's office and say, this is how I worked on this other project before. It doesn't even matter that you don't know the project, the website's not even up anymore, but these are the kinds of deliverables that I produce, and this is my method for getting there. And so it's more about how I think, and I think that that has actually gotten me more jobs as a result because it's someone who's seeing, you know, how I work and not just what the final product is, which someone like me as a user experience designer, I don't even create the final product. So it would kind of be, you know, a showpiece for nothing.
Wireframes.
Yeah, wireframes. But even that is like, well, what is it? What was the problem? And so talking about what you do and writing about it in Twitter is a great way to do that. You know, I frequently, at various stages in a project, I will send tweets talking about exactly what I'm doing. And then the people that follow me get a sense of how I work. And they can talk about that with other people. And that's how I've gotten, through Twitter is really how I've gotten the majority of my gigs since I went full-time in August.
Okay, we said we were going to talk about raising your game. So let's assume that we've gotten some clients, and now we're starting to make some money as a freelancer. How do you get to a better paying client, or a client who's more accepting of your actual design vision? Or how do you get to that next level? Or how do you get rid of a cumbersome client that you don't want anymore?
Well, the idea of moving up is really, really has a lot to do with luck. If you do a site and somebody sees it and they can say that this is sort of like what we need, then you're good. I have to say that some of the most interesting work that I've done have been for sites that I've been fired off of, or if I started a proposal like Bloomberg. There is a famous Lex Fenech, who is the former CEO of Bloomberg, or was the CEO when I was called in, and he, very aggressive, one of the great salesmen of all time, made the mayor of New York what, as rich as he is, and he wanted things a certain way, and he was concerned that the Bloomberg site was cannibalizing their main product, the terminal sales. So he wanted to rethink the website, and I came back and said, you know, what you should do is make it look more like the Bloomberg terminal, so it looks black with amber type and, you know, a command line. And he picked me up and threw me through this magenta glass window. And I was gone. They sent me a check. And it was like, well, oh, I. And then years passed. I get a phone call from one of the people I met at Bloomberg and said, you know, it's funny. We were in with the chairman, the new chairman of the company, Peter Grauer. And he said, you know, why don't we make the website look more like the terminal? And everyone said, that's a really good idea. And someone said, you know, somebody was in here who had that same idea. Who was this? Some designer. And they call me. Somebody remembered. They call me up, and we did the Bloomberg site. And it's black. And actually looks best on the iPhone. And hilariously, the Font Bureau got to do their fonts over. So you got to love that. Anyways, same thing with the Washington Post that I'm working on now. 2 years ago, they call me in. And they said, we want you to do the Washington Post. We want you to bid on the Washington Post. What would you do? And I said, well, first thing, you got to combine the newspaper newsroom and the website newsroom. And it evidently, with that group, that was the worst thing I could have said. I might have said they should have merged with the New York Times. I mean, it was like antithetical to everything that they wanted to do. But I thought it made all the sense in the world. And so I did all this work. We didn't do any design work, but I did a big proposal and research and all this stuff, and came with a big tap dance and brought my best people, da 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 da, and they call up and said, never mind. So 2 years passed. They call up. Somebody at the new CEO says, what the hell do we have two newsrooms for? Why don't we combine the newsrooms and have one have one newsroom for the website? And it was the same thing. You know, funny, somebody said that. And so they called me back, and without almost any big tap dance, I got the job to design not only the newspaper, but the website, and it's an integrated project. And that's pretty amazing. So what's the lesson? The lesson is, go ahead and tell them what you think. Do not try to mirror what they are or what you think they want. They don't usually know what they want. What you need to do is reflect what your idea is, take your best shot at it, even if you think it's a long shot or that they're not going to understand. Try to explain it as well as you can. And then if you don't get the job, don't worry about it. Somebody there who's smart will get fired and hire you for the next one.
Yeah, it's about confidence, honestly. Like, when I was charging clients a lot less than I thought I was worth, I was getting really shitty gigs. When I started charging what I thought I was worth, even though I was shocked by the, like, when I tallied it all up and that was going to be the project rate, I was like, oh my God, how can I possibly ask someone to give me that much money? And then I asked for it, and shockingly, they said yes, and they'll continue to say yes, because you kind of set that bar for yourself and you live up to it. You know, if you have the confidence that you can do really great work, you're going to attract really great clients who will have confidence in you, and then it just becomes this self-fulfilling prophecy in a positive direction.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. I think that so many of us are afraid to lose the work, and so we underbid. And then you will get clients who treat you as though that is what your value is. So I really want to second that.
Yeah, it's never, at least in my case, it was never a real problem that people thought I was really extravagantly expensive. Because then we had it in 1972, which was my 72, 73, I started my first studio. It was called Type City in Los Angeles. And we had an expression which was, if they don't squeak, you haven't charged enough. That the thing is that it should be more than they want to pay.
Twitter that, kids.
And the thing is, so now I have, for 30 years, I've had an experience of somebody who's very expensive. If you want him, he's going to cost you a lot of money. This has never hurt me. Because the people who don't want to spend any money don't come to me. And the people who think, well, then they, in the real world, nobody cares. They say, this is what our budget is. Can you deal with it or not? And on that subject, often it really works. And in the old days, it didn't. But now it's working to ask, what do you got? What is your budget? If you say, what are you thinking of? What's the highest you can do? And then and try to go in 10% under that.
We do that now. We do that now.
And
we
they'll
ask
tell
for
you.
Budget first.
Well, they used
because
to
that
not
tells
tell
you how what you can do. I got okay. So one moral from what you guys are saying is, have faith and patience, and always be nice. Suppose you take the person out to dinner. You've had 3 phone calls. You've answered some emails. You even wrote floated a trial balloon proposal at their request. Then nothing happens. You might want to call them up and tell them to screw off. But don't do that, because a year later they're going to hire you, or 2 years later. It took almost 2 years for us to get Housing Works, and they loved us the whole time. They were fighting internal battles to get us. We didn't know that, and so you don't relieve yourself, the other thing, gosh, what is it? Nope. What? Budget. Yeah, okay, this is I like this story, so I'm going to tell it. Okay. A company that shall be nameless contacted Happy Cog as it was several years ago, when it was just me and a partner, Brian Alvey, and a couple of freelance people occasionally, and they needed a big project done. It was like information architecture and copy and design and a back end and a content management system. And I said, okay, it's great. It's going to be $40,000. And the guy said, okay, I'll get back to you. And then a year passed. And the guy called me, and we had many conversations. I put a lot of time into it. Nothing happened, and I was like, oh, well. A year later, the guy calls up. I don't remember the conversations, right? And he's like, I remember that he'd called before. We're talking, and I said, okay, this sounds like it's going to be about an $80,000 job, right? I'd said 40 before, right? I'd said 80 this time. He says, okay. He was French. That was my French. Okay, that's good, but... one question. I'll pay it. We can do it. But one question. Last year I call you and you said 40,000, and now you tell me 80,000. Why is that? Our rates have gone up. He said, okay.
All right.
Corporate guy. He said, okay.
I'd like to add to that. That also, like in dating, being unavailable makes you more desirable. So don't... charge whatever you feel that you're worth, and if you're not available, say that you're not available, and they're going to want you even more. They'll offer to pay more. They'll wait the 3 months until you're available. Whatever. I've got a guy just like that where it's been a year, and every time he comes back and he just wants to work with me more and more.
Well, I think you're talking about your boyfriend.
No. He thinks that, well, he's right? I mean, there are people that want to work with me, so he's even more excited to work with me, and he just needs a little bit more lead time.
It's the dig phenomenon, right? In a way, like people go, this must be a good blog post because 5,000 people dug it. This other one must suck because nobody dug it. They base it on that. It's herd instinct. So the more people who want you, yeah. Okay. One other story, how to get rid of a client. So when I first started Happy Cog, and it was just me, I had a job. How many of you have done this? Making animated GIF banner ads like overnight. Okay? Right? Of like 30 different sizes, and you've got to beat the message out of the guy and kind of write it yourself, and there's no photography. You've got to go take a picture. Like, everything bad, right? Okay. And at the time, it was like it was paying my rent, and it was okay. I got to a certain point where I was getting busier and getting more of a reputation. And so I don't want to fire him. I'm like, he was my first client. I want, you know, I'm kind of sentimental and feel loyal. So I said to him, you know, I think one thing that's maybe we could work on and improve and be more productive for you, better for you, would be if we could start to plan the year of what you're going to need. Because it seems like about six times a year you need banner ads. And we could probably schedule those and have like more, you know, same price. You're not going to pay any more, but I won't have to rush, and you'll have more time to approve them, and we'll have more time to polish them. It'll be great, and I can schedule it with the other work that I'm doing. So what do you think about that? And he didn't respond. And then I said, well, no, seriously, I'd really like to do that with you. What do you think about that? And he said, okay, that sounds good. I said, great, so let's get a schedule together. And it never happened, and it never happened. And then he emailed me, and I need this immediately. Right? And he said he needed it immediately and needed it the next day. And now I'm kind of pissed, right? So I said, okay, well, my rates have gone up. If you take away one thing from this, is keep raising your rates. I said, well, my rates have gone up. They're now, and I quoted him twice, whatever the thing was, and I never heard back from him again. He didn't even reply, and it was awesome because I was free. I was free to pursue other clients.
Classic move.
Yeah.
When you don't want a client, charge a ridiculous amount of money, and then at least you didn't turn them down. Turned you down.
Okay, as a freelancer, Whitney, because you're the only full-time freelancer, mm-hmm. How do you structure your day? Because this would be another worry, I would think, if I was a lot of people say, you know, I'd like to do this, but I'd end up doing my laundry or watching TV and eating chocolate. So how do you schedule your day so that you're actually working? And you want to talk about that a little bit?
I don't. Okay. Well, I have discovered that I work best at night, so I do a lot of meetings during the day and get errands done and stuff like that, and I end up getting the majority of my work done between, it's embarrassing to say, but midnight and 4 a.m. And, you know, it's good because on the one hand, I realize that not everyone else is like me, and I do have meetings with prospective clients and current clients, and they would like to do those during the daytime hours, and that's fine because I'm free and I'm not producing deliverables during the day, so I can go do that. But I really don't have a structure. I think I might need to find one. It's only been since August. I work out of the house part-time, and part of the time I go to a co-working space called Newark City. Where's Tony? Yes, from Newark City. It's a fabulous co-working, if you don't know about it, is a wonderful community for freelancers and independent consultants. So I don't have to work alone. I don't have to work at home. I go to a place where there are other people that are also independent, and we can work together. And so Newark City has been a godsend for me because I love my apartment, but I guess they're crazy. I live in a studio. It's one room. And, you know, I just am self-motivated. So I structure my day based on deadlines. I have three or four clients at a time, and I make sure that my deadlines are realistic because I didn't quit my full-time job to go insane. I mean, this is a life choice, so my deadlines are totally realistic, and when I have one coming up, I'm the kind of person that works best under pressure. I procrastinate, therefore I'm more efficient. There's the deadline, it's tomorrow. Holy shit, maybe I should do this. Oh wait, there's a New York Tech meetup tonight, I gotta go out to that. Come home afterwards, stay up all night, get it done, deliver it, move on to the next
thing. What
about
the sleep part?
I sleep from like 4 a.m. to 9 a.m. I get a great night's sleep.
You know, one thing about that that's, I think, really the greatest part about being a freelancer or being an independent is that your sense of fun and your sense of work are the same thing. And you 100%. don't have to feel bad about not structuring your work as a 9-to-5 thing. you know, most of the people in the world don't think their life begins until 5 o'clock. But if you're doing what you're going to do anyway, and you're having, and it's really great stuff, then you actually like staying up and doing it. And then if there's something else that comes up that gets in the way, it can be good because it's also fun and it's your real life, or it's the personal part of your life or whatever, as opposed to the professional part of your life. And you need, you know, you don't want to just become a total geek. But at the same time, who cares? The thing is that it doesn't matter if it's Saturday or Sunday. It doesn't matter what time of day it is. Sometimes it's work and sometimes it's play, but it all mixes together. And I think that's the best part.
Absolutely. It took me a while to realize, actually. For a few weeks after I quit my full-time job, I was still in this routine until one day I woke up and I was like, wait a minute. I don't have a manager. I don't have anyone telling me what to do. It was like mom was no longer watching over me to see what I was going to do today. And that's when I realized I know what makes me happy and I know how I work best, so I'm just going to do it.
You know, I thought, wow, I can take my Christmas vacation a week before Christmas and beat the crowds, right, all that stuff. I was like, I don't have to, you know, and then I had a kid.
Yeah, who here has kids? Yeah.
Wow.
That was about when I decided it was time for me to hire somebody.
Okay, talk about that.
Kids. Yeah, so that I do want to make sure that we bring the conversation around a little bit too about
small
the
agencies.
Well, about hiring. When do you decide to hire employees?
Please.
And what that's like. I had my son, my firstborn, in September of 2004, and it was September of 2005 that I hired my first employee. And that I loved being a freelancer. It was great, and it was. I also was highly efficient.
Everything has a positive spin.
Yes, yes. But it did come to a point where being in meetings all day and working all night was no longer cool. Like, that was no longer okay with me. And it's certainly not that I don't come home, have dinner with my family, put the kids to bed, and go back to work. I mean, that happens sometimes. You know, I am lucky that I'm in a place where I've got a lot of really smart, hardworking employees who are sharing the love. And so, you know, it's not every night. And I work very hard to control that. But I will say that even just hiring and working with 4 employees, like, it was still a clubhouse, right? Like, we didn't have an employee manual. We didn't have, I mean, people took vacation when they wanted to take vacation. We were all on flex time. It was this little nirvana sort of hive of writers and happiness, right? But I'll tell you that when I first hired my first employee, people were like, oh my God, you have an employee. And suddenly my project size is doubled, like overnight. Suddenly they were like, there's a staff. We can give her more. And then we decided we'd get a little office. And suddenly, oh my God, you have a physical space. You have an office. You must be a real company. And the projects got bigger. Fast forward to now, there are 15 of us. I'm really very proud of the culture that we are continuing to maintain and that is evolving, and the way that people work together and collaborate. We are a group now of content strategists, information architects, and web writers. So we actually, it's a little bit opposite, where we actually will job in designers instead of, usually it's a design firm jobbing in writers. But it's different. And I still have all of my original, you know, those first 4 or 5 employees. And we can't all go to lunch together anymore without restaurants hating us. You know, we can't decide to all sign off at 4:30 and go have happy hour. So it's a different culture, and it's a different level of anxiety and stress to be responsible for the health and wellness and financial well-being of 14 people. But it's an extraordinary journey and opportunity. And it's one that we all sort of decided when there were just 4 or 5 of us that we could not look away from and that we wanted to embrace. So don't kid yourself. It's not sexy running an agency. It may look that way from the outside, but it is complicated, and there's policy and procedure and structure and process that inevitably must be introduced.
I'm going to introduce a question and answer. I know we have more stuff to say here, but we have a gentleman with a question. If you could go up to the microphone to give your question. Thanks very much.
Yes, I own an agency of 3 people, And one of the biggest quandaries is how do you finance additional employees if you need to, and how do you keep your funnel full so that, you know, the projects are always coming in so that you can afford to keep people on board, especially in this economy.
Yeah, tell us your name, please. Name and the name of your company.
Yes, the name of our agency is Culture Lab, and we're in Dallas, and we focus on 18 to 34-year-old diverse young adults.
Cool. Yeah. And your name?
My name is Kevin Walker.
Kevin, thanks. Okay, Roger, Christina.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I will also say that in the last 12 months, I've learned what a pipeline is and cash flow. That's been real fun to learn about cash flow. It depends on how much risk you're willing to take on. I myself, not so much interested in risk. So we are almost solely financed by cash flow. Again, you know, stress and anxiety. So if you are really looking to grow and the work is not there yet and you feel that you need to, I would say don't hire before the work is there. You guys should be like not sleeping at night because you have so much work before you hire on more employees. I mean, you know, getting back to the earlier part of our conversation, there should be outstanding freelancers that you can sort of flex with. And I would suggest too, I mean, even at Brain Traffic, we've got a very, very healthy business right now, but we are on a hiring freeze this year, sort of to be conservative. And but boy, do we have a lot of brilliant freelancers in Minneapolis, and we're building that community. So that's what I would recommend. The pipeline?
Right. How do you keep the
pipeline? How do you keep
the
pipeline?
So to repeat the question, how do you keep the pipeline full?
Well, I think The trick is to get yourself out of the current job enough so that you're thinking about the next jobs.
Yeah.
Because my problem, and I think it's probably just a human problem, is that I get really engrossed into my current problem, and particularly if it's a great project or difficult one or both, then I'll get hit on the head at the end of that because I don't have any, the next projects aren't lined up. And particularly this year when there's going to be a lot of kind of reluctance for people to spend money, you just have to get very proactive. So there are clients that you know might want to hire you again. Start talking to them. You know, get that conversation going, and then think about all the sales things you can do. And I think Jeffrey outlined them perfectly. Your blog is probably the most important thing you can do on that front. Just keep the contact going.
But it is really hard because I believe it or not, in New York, we haven't had a project manager until now. So I've done that. I've been creative director and project manager because I was so hands-on. And I think that was one of the reasons clients were paying for us was like, I get a lot of Jeffrey. Like, I get a lot, you know, but I don't, now I've realized I don't actually have to, in a day-to-day small decision, I don't really need to be involved. Because if I am involved, the job will end and I won't have any other job lined up and all that stuff Roger was talking about. So now I need to find ways to detach.
Yeah,
I think as the agency head, you need to like really trust more, make sure that your people are growing, and like hand stuff off to them and start you know, looking ahead.
One of my favorite things that happen on a sales kind of thing is when the prospective client says, well, we know we're not going to get much of your time. Who are we going to work with? And then you realize that you won.
Yeah.
Next question.
Yeah.
Hi, my name's Kevin Thompson. I'm a user interface engineer / aspiring designer. And I recently went freelance in October, but my question is between the interim of basically leaving my full-time job and before I would actually hire somebody, when a client comes to me and they want something beyond my skill set, what's the best way to approach other industry professionals like designers or marketing individuals? And should I bring those people in and present them to the client, or should I obfuscate that and, you know, act as myself?
Okay. I'll start. That's a great question, and it's something we really wanted to cover, so it's very important. It's like that transition. You're in that transition period. You may stay a freelancer this whole time, or you may eventually have an agency. But, yeah, you definitely find people with complementary skills. When I initially started working with Brian Alvey, who did back-end, we didn't do anything formal. He didn't become a partner in HappyCog. I hadn't even incorporated, to tell you the truth. I was just doing business as HappyCog, and we just were freelancers dividing stuff down the middle. I mean, for a long time, I used to just say, oh, it's a $40,000 job, and there's four of us. We'll each make $10,000. Then I learned to obfuscate that and say, I'm paying you $8,000. Is that okay? And that's okay, because you probably have to keep the office going, or you have phone bills, or you're the one who's, you know, whose neck is on the line if something goes wrong, or someone gets sick and you need to replace them, so you actually need to leave a little bit of extra money for the company, even if it's really just you. As to whether you show everyone or not, if it helps build confidence and build a better job, yes, as long as you're honest about it. You say, this is one of the consultants I'm working with. You don't say, This is my right-hand man. He's been on salary for 10 years and lie, because you always get caught with lies.
I mean, I experience the same thing. So I'm so specialized that there's no way that I could carry out a whole project on my own. I have to work with visual designers and copywriters and developers. And there are times that my clients don't have those resources, and they look to me to find them. So I've been in a couple situations. One where I decided that I wanted the money, so I was going to subcontract out, and I found those people myself, and I became the project manager, which was really difficult because it, I think, diminished the quality of my work as a user experience designer. I also had to eat it when the client decided that they didn't want to pay a portion of it, and then you owe money to other people, and that really sucks. And it's just, it's not my skill set. So ultimately, now I find those people if they want me to, and that's great for me because they're people that I like and want to collaborate with or have been wanting to work with for a while, and now I get the opportunity. I vouch for those people. They get hired by, as consultants or freelancers, by that company as well, and then they're responsible. And so it's a much looser project structure, and I don't have to manage it, but I still kind of have that influence of who I get to work with.
And then I just want to talk about this one corp company structure. Who here remembers Volume 1, Matt Owens? Matt Owens, Flash Pioneer from the 90s, brilliant artist. So he and some other really brilliant people founded an agency, and it's like one step up from all freelancers. They're all partners. They get the job together, and then they hire each other as freelancers. This one's Matt's job, so Matt's the party of record. They do business as agency name, and then they pay each other. That's who I'm talking about, I think. Brooklyn? Brooklyn?
No.
Different. Two companies do this.
Yeah.
Hi.
I'm Dan Winkler. I am a projection designer, visualist, and all-around video guy, and my company is the Really Useful Media Company. And my question follows on well on the last guy's, which is, when you started out, did you struggle with branding yourself, defining your voice? Should I use the royal we and say, he's not in right now, can I take a message? Or how much did you pretend to be a company?
That's a great question.
Yeah. That's great.
I actually was just approached by a writer who was struggling with that in a web writing seminar I just did. And I will just say again, it depends on how you want to position yourself. If you want to position yourself as a collective, right, then it's okay to say we. And if you're going to be like the king of that collective, then that's cool. But ultimately, I think, again, just do not try to pretend to be anything or anyone other than what you are, right? So if you are... And people are going to appreciate that. I mean, what you can say is, hi, this is the name of my company, and this is who I am. And if you need more resources, I've got lots of really brilliant colleagues and collaborators that I can bring to the table. And you'll know you'll get good work because I can vouch for them or whatever.
I now say Happy Cog if I answer the phone, but I used to say, this is Happy Cog, this is Jeffrey Zeldman. And before that, when I was just me, I would say, this is Happy Cog, this is Jeffrey. Mm-hmm. Implying that it might have been someone else, but not lying about it. And before that, I said, hi, it's Jeffrey. And before that, I didn't answer the phone. If you didn't know how to use email, I wasn't going to work with you. So,
And could you also talk about the branding and marketing? Because, when you pick up the phone, it's just you, of course. But
well, I think that it, particularly if it is just you and you're going to use your name on the door, which I've done, you want some kind of personal branding. I was lucky enough. I mean, I'm older than some of you, and I started in 1972-73 on my first company, and we started Type City, and then I started something called Roger Black. Clever, huh? And the logo I designed in 1973 is still my logo. And there's something, I mean, there have been corporate changes, and I sold companies and yada, 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 but I At some point, I actually registered it as a trademark and licensed it to my company so that I couldn't sell my name, like Calvin Klein or somebody. And that really has helped me, I think, in the long run. I think if you are a team and you project yourself as a team, it still should be totally transparent. But if you're you got to do some personal branding from day one.
And I just want to say real quickly, the reason that we are called Brain Traffic is because Christina Halverson was too hard to spell when I was an independent. Seriously. So I went out and found a name. And even though it was just me, it was Brain Traffic.
Especially if you're a designer, the way to do branding is with design. If you're a writer, do it with your tone of voice. Write a really funny blog or something like that. But if you're a designer, and a good example is go to weightshift.org, Naz Hamid. It's really one guy, Naz.
Five minutes,
good. Okay, but when a potential client looks there, they see that there's this company, but they also see when they go to the About page that it's one guy. And that's a way of being honest, but also showing that you have aspirations and that you're a serious professional.
I just want to add one thing, differing perspective. I have no intention of being perceived as a company, and I've done everything to ensure that I'm not perceived as a company because I haven't wanted to take on those bigger projects and have to subcontract out. So I have a company name. I'm incorporated, and I get paid to that, but no one knows it. I don't promote it. I don't have a website for it. I have a blog at whitneyhess.com. I only talk about myself as an individual, and I don't have any collateral. So I purposefully haven't gotten a logo or anything because I haven't wanted that perception created.
Lightning round. Next.
Hi, Raven Zachary, and I'm actually going the other direction. I have a personal brand, and I'm moving from a freelance to an agency and want to kind of find a new name for everyone involved opposed to naming it after myself, Raven.me, which is the current name. I work in the iPhone space. Question about ownership structure. So I had a plan to be freelance. That's changed. I now have 3 employees moving to 7. And tell me a bit about the thought processes for at least the 3 of you on stage who have an agency model now, how you deal with ownership structure around your employees.
Well, it used to be that we would give out stock or stock options. And particularly when in the tech boom, we had a company called Interactive Bureau that got up to about 100 employees, and then we merged into something that became Circle.com. And the incentive for particularly senior employees, but eventually everybody, was stock. And that was when we had an IPO. It was publicly traded, and everybody was pushing forward to what was ultimately a giant collapse. Now, and really since then, and in New York City, particularly since 9/11, the whole idea of stock options is laughable. I mean, even Google the options are underwater, and they have to come up with a different offer for the employees.
I think it's money.
So what we do is something called I love the model that Goodby Silverstein in the ad agency in San Francisco did when they first started. It was actually called Goodby Berlin Silverstein, and they said to their top 5 people, not partners. The partners still own the company, but they said to their top 5 people, "Okay, whatever profit we make this year, you split it among yourselves." And next year, we'll probably go down in that percentage a little bit. But we're going to give you the profit. And it was the first year they made money. And so what we do in our little company is something called shadow profit, where we have, assuming we make profit, there's a bonus that's based on that, and people know what that is.
Yeah, I'll say very, very quickly, I'm the sole owner of Brain Traffic. Whether or not it will stay like that forever, I don't know. Partnership and stock ownership are very, very complicated, and they can get very messy very quickly. So before you start handing out and distributing stock, please talk to a lawyer and talk to somebody who specializes in these deals. Because what starts out as a really super happy love fest where, my God, we're making so much money and we want to share all of this ownership with everyone, can go very sour very quickly. I say that not from direct experience, but from all of the reading and conversations I've had around it.
And Happy Cog is actually 2 companies. The New York company and the Philadelphia company are structured completely differently. The Philadelphia company has salaried employees, this brilliant team. They come in, punch the clock. They don't actually punch the clock. They stroke the clock. But it's an ink. And Happy Cog New York is a consultancy, and it's a single owner, me, LLC, and I work almost exclusively with freelancers, just like top freelancers that I bring in specifically custom tailored for each project. So we decided to it's just two companies. It's two companies with one brand. The brand, there's an LLC that owns the brand, and then there's a whole.
If you're thinking
and that's simple, and my eyes cross, but that's actually simple.
If you're thinking about bringing on a partner, there's a really great book I can recommend called The Partnership Charter that's worth a read. Do we have time?
We got one more.
Oh, no.
One more? No more? No more. What? No more?
No, she gave you the thing.
Oh,
we can't.
We can't. I'm sorry. But we can do it right after.
Yeah,
thank you, everybody.
We'll stay.